Welcome to Pop Culture Retro, which was recently voted the 15th best podcast by the residents of the Golden Years Retirement Community in Boca Raton, Florida. Each show, we'll revisit some of your favorite pop culture memories with insider and outsider perspectives. Now, please help me welcome your hosts, Ike Eisenman and Jonathan Rosen.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Pop Culture Retro. I'm one of your hosts, Jonathan Rosen, along with Ike Eisenman. And today we are thrilled to welcome someone who's had an incredible and varied career. He's one of the producers of the fascinating documentary True Love. He's been a business entrepreneur, has his own furniture brand. He's the co-host of the Real Brady Bros podcast and also starred in one of the most iconic TV series of all time, The Brady Bunch. Please help us welcome Christopher Knight. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jonathan. Thank you.
Well, as I mentioned, you've had such an incredibly varied career, and we're going to try to fit in as many aspects of it as we can. But to start with, I have to say that we've had a lot of famous guests on, but I think this is the most excited that my kids have been about someone appearing.
Your kids, really?
My kids, yes.
We're a little ancient at this point for children to even know about us, but... You know, kids are driven to kids and they don't know about time frame. So,
well, it's amazing to me for a series that ended, like I said, 30 years before they were born. But, you know, we'll discuss all that. But first, you got into the business at a really young age. Your father was an actor and appeared on several shows. Was that something that you looked at as something that you wanted to do as a kid or that it looked fun? Or were you just pushed into it kind of?
I was pushed into it, but I hate even saying that because it, parents are always, they have ideas for their children, that maybe aren't shared by the child. Like chocolate all the time is a child's wish, and a parent, it will probably steer you away from that. So yes, they naturally pushed me into it because it was my dad's career path. And, I look back at it and I say it makes sense in light of the situation that we were in as a family and that my dad recognized as normal from how he grew up. I mean, normal in so far as he's first generation, you know, American, his parents coming from Middle Europe. Times were tougher, you know, in the generations prior to my dad, and my dad experienced part of, you know, his childhood through the Depression. It wasn't uncommon for children to work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's coming right at, I mean, that becomes uncommon in his generation and therefore mine. So the idea of children going to work to, you know, to earn money for the family, or in his case, you know, putting money away for school because it wasn't something that his career was going to be able to provide me. That was the the excuse for getting us an agent so we could start to work. Also, you know, what kind of resume does a 7-year-old need? You know, when they're walking into an interview for the first time, they don't. My dad recognized that. He knew which agents existed for children. That was really more or less, are they cute? Can they stand in front of a camera? Can you, you know, whether will they stay still long enough? And he didn't know what the answer was to that, and got us an agent. And then we took it from there, or my mom and us took it from there because she had to go on the interviews with us. So be careful what you wish for. And my brother, who is a year older, went on every interview with me because we'd be going up for the same roles, and he never worked. And I actually got the very first interview, the second, the third interview, first, third, and then it just rolled from there. And within a couple of years, there was this Brady Bunch that came on.
Well, I had a very similar experience. It was like, that was the thing in the 70s. It's like the children of, you know, other actors went into the business to earn money for college. That's just what the whole point of it was. But your first credit was on Mannix, which was my second credit in around the same time with starring Mike Connors, which was also ironically a series that Robert Reed became a semi-regular on. How many auditions? Well, you said that was, I'm guessing that was your third audition because you just said you got your
third gig. Because that was the first speaking role I had. So I did, I did all these commercials.
Okay,
The first job I got, the first interview I went on was for a Purex bleach commercial, where I believe it was, I ran into home plate. It wasn't even though I was recognizable, because you would get paid as an actor, you know, two different levels. You don't get reuse if you're not recognizable. You get paid for the workday. And that was my, you know, I don't know how, why you get selected, you know, why you even need an interview for that. You're going to have a kid slide into home plate, find, you know, any kid that's, you know, I guess they have to be with the union. So there's an interview for that. Not that I can remember. I do remember where the interview was held at, though. That's interesting. But I don't remember what I was asked to do in the interview. I don't believe I was asked to slide down the hallway. but that's all I was, that's what the requirement was. That's all I did. And looking back on it and having spent some time casting, I wonder now what I would have done as a casting agent to cast that role. Because almost any kid could do it, but I got lucky and got it. Like, why me? Why not my brother? Did I convince them more in the interview that I could slide? Was my slide technique better? You know, I don't think I showed them that. And then it just went from there. But speaking, as it's still a challenge for me, was much more of a challenge when I was younger. I would recognize later that I had ADD, and I had this, you know, energy that was trying to be controlled. Sentences would come out kind of sideways, you know, like instead of like one, like a shotgun, one word at a time in a sequence, it would like turn the sentence sideways and blurt them all out at the same time and make no sense at all. That's sort of what happened under pressure. So, getting a role and speaking was a whole new challenge. And Mannix was the first representation of that, where I had a speaking role. And I think that came about a year. That was in 68, if I'm not mistaken. And I believe it was Coffin for a Clown was the name of the episode. I believe it was in season three of Mannix, season two or three.
I think it was two.
Season two?
I think so. I think that's what I read. I have to check, but I think it was two.
I recently, a friend got me the whole Mannix set, and I, from that, was able to deduce what the episode was and what year it was. And because my whole childhood is kind of a cloud, like everyone's is. There's more data points to go back and collect. And that was that, looking at that DVD set and saying, okay, Mannix was in 68. I know it was in the early part of my career. How close was it to Brady? And in looking back on that, actually, I recognize that there, having done that episode, I was a known entity, by those casting at Paramount. It had to have something to do with the fact that, not that I got the role on the Brady Bunch, but that I was a trusted enough commodity, because one of the things Sherwood wanted is raw children. Now, he got it with me. I don't know. He had some pretty polished actors in Barry and Eve, Maureen. Not that anyone had a great amount of experience. Barry did. But Sherwood didn't want child actors, interestingly. He wanted kids who could act. Yeah. And it's interesting because it is different. And I was just raw, and all I could be was me. That's probably the reason I got the role.
Well, what was the process like on that? How did you come on to be on the show? The process that you went through with Sherwood to get on there?
Well, that's, you know, also something that's very vague. I don't recall. It's fractured memories that I have on this. There was no screen test that I remember. And I remember the interview, and I don't know if there was a callback, but I don't know if the callback was when, I think it was that it might have been the second interview. It was more or less being around a coffee table with Sherwood and others, and just, I think they had Matchbox toys on the table, which certainly riveted, you know, my attention. And I was just playing with the the Matchbox isn't answering their questions. Interestingly to me, and I wouldn't know this until I was an adult later in life, my brother was the outgoing one. He's a year older. The dominant of, you know, I'm subject to him growing up. You know, if I was going to live, it was because he was going to let me. So I was more introverted, and my mom's expectation was is that my brother would work, and perhaps not Chris, because you can't get a word out of him. And so she was baffled as to what was happening inside the room, because parents don't go in the interview. They bring the child to the office, check the child in, and wait outside as the child is brought in for that interview. And I wasn't brought into the interview with my brother, so I had no idea what he did. But in getting the call that Chris got the interview, my mom, and she wouldn't share this with me until I was, well, might have been only 25 years ago, that she was baffled by that, because she was certain that my brother, with the outgoing personality, was the one more apt to get, you know, get a role or work in the entertainment industry. And then it was me. So she didn't understand what that was about. And I think it was just simply because when I got my focus on something like a Matchbox toy, that's all. I was really there in that moment. And luckily for me, that's what Sherwood was looking for. So the process was just that. It was a personality test. Wow. If it was a talent audition, I wouldn't be speaking with you today, because that's not something that I possessed at that time. I had no idea what I was doing. Matter of fact, on the Mannix episode, I think I had, not very many lines, 3 or 4 lines. But even knowing when it was I spoke was, I needed someone to tell me now.
Right. Wow.
As opposed to just doing it on my own, it's like, can I speak now? Luckily it worked out. It worked out, and it worked out well enough that it didn't take extra time, that those in power at Paramount didn't check me off a list and said never again. I was circled as opposed to checked. And that proved to be valuable when the Brady Bunch would come around, because if I'm not mistaken, so Coffin for a Clown, I was September, October airing. So it was an earlier show in the second season of Mannix. That would have been early in 68. I would have shot that in, probably springtime. And we were doing the pilot for the Brady Bunch then that September. So it was within the same calendar, within the same 12-month period, or maybe even within the same calendar year, that I worked for Paramount twice.
Wow. Well, what did you think of the concept of the Brady Bunch before you started filming?
Interesting, because you're asking that now of an adult looking back on his 10-year-old self.
It's rough, but we're pushy.
It's like, I don't know if I had concepts about concepts, what's a 10-year-old's concept of work other than survive? this is another, I liked the work part. I hated the interview process. The interview process for me was coming home from school and seeing my mom dressed up, which could only mean one thing. Whatever I had planned wasn't happening. I was getting in the car and we were driving into Hollywood and I was going on an interview. So it was always disappointing to know that I had an interview. But then getting the job, the jobs were fun, because all of a sudden now, for a child, had a new experience. You were important. You were important in someone else's world that moment or that day, more so than you felt at home. You were a bother at home. But when you show up for work and people are expecting you you're not coddled, but you have a level of attention that maybe I was yearning for. My mom, I think with the three of us at four of us at home, where it was stretched. So, getting the job was always fun. Going on the interview wasn't. So I do remember this about the interview though. We were, my dad, growing up for a number of summers, was at, would work over the summer at the Old Globe Playhouse in San Diego doing Shakespeare. And that would provide the family then, you know, a 6-week vacation down in San Diego at a, you know, at a rental that they put the family up in. In this particular summer, 68, through the interview process for the Bradys, or the later interview process, the callback, if you will, we were down in San Diego. And my aunt was staying at our house, my dad's sister, taking care of our dog. And there was no cell phones at the time. I don't believe there was even a phone in the room that we were staying in. My dad had this, whenever he was in the proximity of Tijuana, he found it as a shopping opportunity to bargain for a dime. You can buy stuff for a dime. You know, my dad, I don't, he's an old school barterer, you know, and he bought a bunch of pots, a bunch of like terracotta pots. And he would go down, you know, in his free time, buy pots, bring them back to the, you know, this apartment. And they, you know, my mom was looking at this going, yeah, how are you going to get the family home? You got all these pots. We got a little station wagon, a little like Honda, not, was it a Datsun at the time, station wagon. You got a family of six. How are you getting the pots and the family home? And my dad never really even thought that far. He said, well, I guess I'll have to take a couple of trips. I'll take the pots back before. So he called his sister to tell her he was coming home, warning her he was going to come home a little early because he had to drop off some pots. And she said, oh, bring Chris with you. He has a callback. I would have never known about the callback if my dad hadn't bought terracotta pots.
Well, that's amazing.
Talk about life's, you know, a lesson in life and how much of it's luck.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Totally. Well,
Were you aware of the older actors? I mean, you were so young, but you were aware of like Robert Reed, Florence Henderson, and Ann B. Davis. Were you like who they were or anything?
No, I had no idea who they were. Mm-hmm. I frankly, I watched television. I mean, we had a we had an old Admiral black and white television. So my dad was in Los Angeles because the idea of television was he wasn't terribly proud of. So maybe for the theater actor ilk that my dad was from Broadway, now with the family, he was starving on Broadway, right? And there's only so much work one can get on Broadway, and he had this growing family, and at the same time there was this new business out in Los Angeles that one if one was an actor could make money at. Not that real actors wanted to do it, but you could be excused by your brethren if you did it because your family was starving. So as a way to feed your family, you would do this thing called television. and it was based in Los Angeles. So my grandparents, his parents, had moved out to Burbank. So one summer, I think it was in 59, I was 2 years old. My dad was driving cross country with the family at that point of four. My mom would become pregnant on the trip over with my sister to check out this industry and spend a week at Thanksgiving with his family and then drive back to New York. That was the concept. We never went back. But the idea was he was coming out to check out this business called television, which he was loath to do, but it would be a way to put food on the table. I mean, my experience of acting is it's just surviving. It's scrape artists that scrape to get by, like very intelligent and educated near homelessness is poetic homelessness is sort of my experience with this. That's the reason we were in Los Angeles and why my dad then a number of years later would get us an agent because of this thing called television that would ultimately prove to be quite lucrative. for the family and benefit the family. So, but it's interesting how reluctant a theater actor was at the time to do this thing.
Oh yeah, it was always the thing. So the theater actors, the film actors, and the television actors, and never the, you know, twain shall meet. But certainly glad you did. You were a part of shaping television for sure. How long did it take you for you to realize that the series was a hit?
I don't know if we felt it was a hit, because we were always struggling to get picked up. We I believe it was only the third season, we got picked up for an entire year. So for every other year we got picked up, we got picked up for 13 episodes, the front half of the season, and then the back half. There was a different number of episodes. I think we did 25 episodes in the first season, 24, second, 23, and then 22. So, but normally the back half is, the first half is 13 episodes, and the back half is then 10 or, you know, 11. We were picked up for just, you know, the fall season. And if you did well enough, you got picked up then for the continuation into spring. And then again, waited to see if you got picked up for the next fall. But it was only 1 year where we got picked up for all 22 episodes. And that's because if you're, you know, top 20 show, normally that's what's going to happen. If your ratings are going to fall off, they'll see a trend line earlier than that. Of course, depending on what's programmed opposite, you could change things overnight. And that's ultimately, you know, what happened to us with Sanford and Son being scheduled on Friday nights opposite us. And I believe that was in our fourth season, started doing eroding our ratings. But our ratings were always in the top 20, not the top 20, in the top half of, you know, near the top 30. So 28, 29, 31, 32, right around in there, which is sort of the cutoff where it's a brutal industry. And even at the time in that, you know, having a top 30 show, if you're 30, you're pulling probably 30 million audience, which is, you know, a third more than Dancing with the Stars does today, which is the highest rating show today. It's just simply because there was the networks, there were only three. There was nothing else to watch. You know, there wasn't any social media. People were just on television watching one of three network channels. So you had much more, less division. It was more broadcasting as opposed to today's narrow casting. So we, you know, even though it was 30 million people, if you didn't get, you know, 230 million people, you were canceled. So we were, the success that we had felt, and this is kind of mind blowing for a kid, you know, you don't have these projections, or I didn't, you know, these awarenesses. I've talked to Barry about this, but, and maybe he did, because he knew he wanted to be an actor. He knew what that was. Something about the whole process was something he wanted to participate in. I wasn't at all aware of it. I mean, I did watch television, but I turned it off, and it never dawned on me that there were people. I mean, I was watching people, but that you could actually, you know, those people had lives, and they lived in real time. Outside of that square, and that you could write to them. Because when that started happening to me, it was like, what? And I remember, and I was quite young to realize this, that my question was, why didn't I know that you could write to these people? Like I had some, you know, maybe Johnny Quest wasn't real, but I had those on television who I was a fan of, and would come to learn after being in the industry that those were real people. They came before me. They had careers before me, but I knew nothing of the history of television. So I didn't know the Bob Cummings Show, never watched it. Didn't know the Defenders. And, you know, Florence's career was rather new at the time. So there was nothing there to have had watched. I mean, what shows was Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea? It was my favorite Martian I was watching. You know, standard classic television. I mean, I certainly, Ronnie Howard, you know, Opie would be somebody who I remember. Dennis the Menace, you know, and, you know, Leave It to Beaver. When I realized I could have written them, not that I would have ever picked up a pen and known what to write, but it was just a revelation to me about how you could write a person. And how did these people know that you could, or what's wrong with me that I never even imagined? But so the idea of success was people are recognizing.
So that's what I was about to add. You're like
an encapsulated piece of success. There's two types of success. It's like all of a sudden this is new, that you're on something. And as a result of that, people are watching at home and now you're getting recognized. And people think they know you. And that's just that's a wild space to be in. You don't have to be tremendously successful for that to happen, right? So the industry's idea of success is a show that gets picked up. Now, you could be a person who's on a series, doesn't last, but still people are going to recognize you. The idea that you're not always holding your breath for the second half of a season, you know, sort of, you know, left you with the feeling that you're successful, but you could be more successful. You know, you're in a journeyman space. You're not a star. You're important, but sure, there's others who are much more important. So that superstardom is not something we ever felt with the show. Now, this show always played in that range. And only through time has it become more successful because it's compounded its own success over time. So every time I look in the rearview mirror, it's bigger than it was the last time I looked in the rearview, just simply because of the amount of time there has been with it. And that's kind of weird. Well, unique.
We've had a lot of guests who starred in things as kids, and they said it wasn't necessarily such a good thing in their schools if they were on hit TV shows. How were you treated at school and by your peers?
My refrain, my mom never understood, was I just want to be normal. But I knew I was. I just want them to know I'm a normal kid. Right. And she didn't. She completely was baffled by this idea of wanting to not be special, because it was anathema to me to be special, because I had an innate understanding of what that meant. If you accept special, you're ostracized. So when this all of a sudden started, I had no problem making friends in school. Right. With all types of people. And then all of a sudden I have this baggage that I'm showing up to school with, which is that people recognize me and think they know me. And now for whatever reason, they think that I think that I'm special. And, you know, I got to convince them that I'm not. And how do you do that? Ultimately it was a misery. You know, literally the show came out when I was in sixth grade. So by the time I was showing back up to school for the first time, I was in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. Now, here we're in Los Angeles, that's the beginning of junior high. You're a scrub. There's already this big jump from elementary school to junior high, leaving all kids making that transition vulnerable and uneasy, because the older kids are telling you what the kids are going to do to you. They're going to, you know, they're going to hold you down and, you know, write lipstick and draw on you and stuff like this. And it's almost like you're waiting for this traumatic, you know, bullying to occur. And it's endemic, you know, it's just a bunch of stories, but you're just frightened to death at the change anyway. And now I show up to school and I'm immediately sort of a target, like, you know, I'm a lightning rod of sorts. And it's like, wait, I'm just like you. Ultimately, it turned out that if there was nothing, if you didn't react, then that wasn't fun for him. You know, teasing is something 12-year-olds do, you know, naturally. And, but give them very little to tease you for, and you become less interesting to them. And ultimately holding out your hand to shake them and asking what their name is and introducing yourself sort of all of a sudden normalizes. And then you become you in their world as opposed to a character. So it took a year and a half for that unease to dissipate and me to make friends with everybody, but it worked. And it's left me in this place where you never, you know, it never accept the pedestal you're placed on. The whole feet of clay thing, you know, just if anybody ever puts you on a pedestal, in my opinion, get down.
Well, famously, Sherwood Schwartz and Robert Reed had a lot of clashes about the scripts on the show. Was that something that was noticeable to all of you, or was it mostly kept away from the kids?
Surprise to me. Completely kept from us. They, you know, we had hours that we had to work. The crew on our show had a schedule that they could keep because it wasn't as though we were going to work late into the night, but any scenes between Robert and Florence were going to be done after the kids were dismissed. Right. We had our 8 hours, you know, normally if we were in at 8:30, we were out at 5:30, and at 9 o'clock, mostly we're in at 9 o'clock, we're out at 6:00. So if there were scenes between Florence and Bob, they would occur after we were dismissed. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that angst apparently played out after we had left on in those scenes and or in Sherwood's office or on the periphery. And we, if it was, you know, not summertime, then we were in school too. So we were constantly, you know, focused on other things as kids. And there was a healthy recognition by Sherwood and Bob, even though they were going through this themselves, that it shouldn't play out in front of the kids. And I wasn't at all aware of it. And I was 16 at the time it ended and had very little idea.
Wow.
But then again, I might've just, you know, I'm that kind of person focusing on other things and, you know, just not noticing the beats.
Sure. Sure.
Like, why is Bob not in the show?
Well, Barry Williams has stated that he had a huge crush on Maureen during that time, as well as Florence Henderson. So what about you? Were there any flirtations between you and Maureen or Eve?
Eve was flirtatious almost from the start. I mean, maybe not from the start, but let's just give it maybe 2 years in. So there was this, you know, almost like a pairing of amorous approaches. Mike and Susan was more of a play thing. Barry was always chasing after Maureen, and I was being chased by Eve, completely wanting to ignore it and run from it. I wasn't ready for any of it, you know. I think it was late in, like, the, you know, fifth season, maybe in the fifth season, when I looked over and saw that, you know, wow, you know, something either changed in Eve or something changed in me, because all of a sudden it's like, but now the show was over and there we weren't going to be kept together. And I, you know, Barry actually pointed it out to me, you know, when he was writing his book, that it's only natural. I mean, our environment, you know, although it wasn't completely our only environment, because I did end up going back to my regular school at the 20 week break, because we would work from, you know, mid June. Soon as school got out, we would start production, and we would work right on through about February. The second week of February, and that's the 20 week break. So I'd go back to my regular school. So I had those other friends, but for that, you know, the people that you're going to most probably or first recognize, you know, in a sexual kind of way, are those that you're closest to. Mm-hmm. So it was, I mean, Barry pointed out, it's probably only natural that ultimately the first person that you would have eyes for would be Eve, because she's there, you know, and you know her. But then by the time I was prepared, the show was over and we were going separate ways. So. Well, but the Barry Maureen thing was hysterical from my point of view, because who was I to be somebody's wingman? I was driving in with Maureen every day, where Maureen was driving in with us, because her mom couldn't drive and she didn't live far. So we met every morning and drove in together and drove home together. And that gave me this extra hour, 2 hours a day with Maureen, to ask questions of for Barry, or for her to seed me with a chore to get information. I mean, it's like, that's how you do it back in school, right? Tell her this and I'll tell her this for, you know, but you know, I apparently was no good at it because I didn't help them along at all. That was just a constant chase.
Well, I also read that at certain points, the kids became frustrated with the storylines or the wardrobe that they were made to wear. You know, that Maureen and Eve didn't wear underwear or bras as a protest. So was that true? And were there times that you were frustrated with, you know, Peter's storylines or something?
Well, you know, Barry and I now doing our podcast, we're getting a better view of what this show actually was. It's interesting because it became very clear when we did HGTV's Very Brady renovation that we were out of sync with our audience. Our audience actually got to the point where they thought we grew up in that house, right? Not only didn't we grow up in the house, we weren't real family. You know, it became ingrained on people that this is like almost a reality show at this point. And the things that people like about the show are stuff that we're not aware of because we're not watching the show. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if our audience recognizes that, but that's not unnatural for an artist, an actor, not to consume their own product. I mean, watching it once, perhaps, you know, twice, but not to dwell on it, not to watch it, not to consume it like a fan would, watching it 200 times. So we've lost touch with what the shows were. Matter of fact, I had no idea that the first 2 years of the show had so much Florence and Bob, and the dynamic was completely different in the early years than it was, you know, from year three, especially four and five, where, you know, the plots no longer fit the ages we had become. And there was no room really to grow with the kind of comedy that was being written, the simplicity that was there. So there was some frustration at that point as we were becoming adolescents and dealing with problems in the same way we did when we were, you know, 10 or 11, it didn't fit. You couldn't wear it as well. You couldn't perform it as well. And things became a little bit more forced, but the comedy was always rather broad anyway. When I look at it, you know, some of it, it's almost, you know, when you're doing a play, you know, you build a really rudimentary set, if you will. You're not going to be building a set for every scene because there's no room for it. So you build something suggestive for whatever the need is. And that it has to work in all parts of that play. And if you're doing vaudeville, you know, if you're doing high school theater, you're doing, you know, a painted psych, and you know, it's accepting. It's you're creating an environment that is completely unrealistic, but the audience buys into it. And the Brady Bunch was sort of like that, you know, in that, yeah, not all things had to make sense because, you know, it's a simple comedy. And I watch it now and I realize, you know, it really had. Its roots in that early comedy, that kind of vaudeville, that you know, a sketch comedy that Sherwood wrote, you know, back in the 50s, you know, when he was part of Red Skelton writing crew. And so when I look at it and I get frustrated from an actor's point of view, which is similar to, I'm sure, how Robert was frustrated by some of the stuff. It was because as an actor, he's wanting it to be, he's wanting his stuff to be like I would as an adult, more real, less suggestive, broad. So there was not going to be a meeting of those minds. They come from different places. It worked fine for me as a kid and stopped working as well as I grew older. I appreciate it in watching it. But I transitioned to more, you know, not having any consciousness to being more like Bob ultimately. And the scripts would be very difficult from my adult perspective now to try to perform to. And I watch the shows and I see even that struggle occurring in the fourth and fifth years, but me not being aware of what it is I'm struggling with. Now watching it, I see what we were dealing with. And the shows in the first couple of years were much, much more well-crafted. They had an idea of what this was. This was a show about a newlywed couple who were now going to be influenced by their kids. And that works really well. I look back on the first 2 years now, and I recognize that they're the superior years. I have and had owned a recollection of the show as being funnier and better when we were older. But it that's now not how I view it. And this is only from having done the podcast and watching the shows like our audience does. But I see our audience also enjoying it on a whole different level and kids enjoying it on a whole different level. And that is, it's just family. And they don't care as much that some of the stuff that Bob would have a problem with, that I would have a problem with as an adult, you know, discontinuities and logics that don't make sense, structures that are odd, forced jokes are all overlooked. It's all innocent because of how the show is being consumed and why it's being consumed. It's just comforting. The warm blankie.
Yeah. Well, I've heard you say that the Hawaii episodes were your favorite, and I was incredibly envious of those episodes. Did you all have a lot of free time to explore on your own when you weren't filming?
No, not yeah. us. The guys worked in every scene. So we were working the whole time, though we were outside and we were in Hawaii, which is, it's a treat. I mean, when we were locked up on stage 5 and, you know, on the lot there at Paramount, having to work, you know, all the time in Hawaii was better than that. So at least even though it was that the girls had, you know, so much free time to do whatever they wanted while we were there. I think we were only there for 6 days. So it wasn't that long anyway, but I think they probably had 2 days off of those six, maybe more. And we worked the whole time because the episodes revolved around the boys or so. So they got to enjoy the island a little bit more than we did. But we did, you know, hit a few of the spots on location. Like Pearl Harbor, the Arizona Memorial. So we got to see, I got a feel for what Hawaii was and would have the chance later to go back and enjoy it more. And then recognize in retrospect how much it was that the whole opening of Hawaii to the American family was presented by the Brady Bunch, because the Hawaii was known as this exotic, faraway place.
Oh,
that, you know, maybe you would know about if you traveled to the Far East or if you were in the military, but not approachable or affordable for a family until we had big enough planes to get us there cheaply enough with the 747. And then the Bradys presented that to America. And I didn't realize this until we did a special, I think it was in 2004, we went back to Hawaii, and then it was explained to us by those in government there, you know, in Honolulu. They gave us the keys to the city and, you know, told us how much that helped Hawaii and the whole idea of Hawaii being a family vacation destination, that it was approachable and affordable, and the Bradys showed that.
Well, I'm curious, when you went to Hawaii and like location shots, like Ohio, were you able to even film? You like rock stars coming in. I mean, was that something that was very tough to deal with shooting wise?
Well, I mean, in Hawaii, we're working at the Sheraton Waikiki, staying at the Royal Hawaiian right next door. And yeah, the locations were right there. The shots were set up right where there's a whole lot of vacationers. So, and now vacationers know who we are. We're in our fourth season, so they've had 3 years to know who the Bradys are and recognize us. So it just means that there's more people to keep out of the shot, you know, more yellow tape to roll out. And Cincinnati was really interesting because now we're in a, you know, an amusement park. And everybody who went into the park on those days that we shot had to sign a waiver because they were going to be walking at some point, and they had to sign the waiver to know that they were going to be on screen and were okay with it, or they couldn't enter the park that day. And most people say, fine, yeah, I hope maybe I end up on screen, so I'll be fine to sign this thing. So, and they use that. And that episode really wasn't much of an episode. It was more or less just a montage of people running through the park.
Well, I mean, on that visit to Kings Island Park, the story famously goes that they wanted to send you up the roller coaster without testing the camera rigging first. I mean, is that true? And how nervous were you afterwards when the initial time the camera came loose?
So I heard about that afterward. So I didn't even, because they wanted to keep that from us, because apparently that had happened in a test run earlier. And perhaps it was better that they didn't tell us that that had happened. Maybe we wouldn't have wanted to get on the roller coaster, but yeah, the idea was that they were, you know, needed to shoot us on the roller coaster. So a camera had to be mounted facing backward. And of course, with high enough so that you could see not just the first row of seats, but the Brady's in subsequent rows as well. And someone, I don't know how it went down, somebody suggested, let's send the camera through first. And it came back without the camera on the head.
Oh, geez.
Because of the clearances and all. And, you know, that was it was smart. I mean, because literally imagine that the camera is gone. The camera's operator's face would have been in an eye lens, and he wouldn't have been seeing what was coming, and it would not have been just the camera.
Wow.
And so, but it's not, I mean, I would say that it would have been abnormal to not, I mean, I guess you didn't have to ruin a camera. They should have done it on a, you know, measure it first. So clearly what they weren't expecting the clearance, they must have expected the clearance to be within the range of the camera, or they didn't even think of it. But someone thought of it enough to send the camera through without a person on it.
I read it was Robert Reed, so I'm not sure if that's, you know, accurate or not. I read it was him that suggested it, but don't know.
I don't recall if, you know, there's so much lore. It might have been that, you know, if Bob would have suggested it, he would have been there, and it's possible he was around watching them set up. And that's how it was that they were able to keep it from all of us, that none of us were paying attention and only Bob was. But it worked out.
Thankfully. Well, during the last season, you know, Robbie Rist was introduced, his cousin Oliver. So not that anyone was annoyed at Robbie, but was there an annoyance in general among the cast that the network was changing things up and the dynamic of the show?
Well, there wasn't a term for it at the time. There would become the famous phrase from Happy Days, what to call it. But our, you know, I mean, I guess we could have coined it ourselves. It's, you know, you're all of, you know, you're Oliver moment, you know, it's like jumping the shark moment for us was Oliver, and made complete sense to me, because the feeling that I was having that this show is we're leaving an age range where we can play this stuff. Mm-hmm. So if you want to, you know, literally, if you want to keep writing for younger kids, you kind of have to have a whole new family to write for. And here was an expression of that. So part of that, you know, was then even made more real by the episode, the spinoff episode that would come in that fifth season, the Kelly Kids,
right.
with Ken Berry and Todd Lookinland, Michael's actual real life brother, as one of the kids, you know, a whole other family. But again, right in line with where all of Sherwood's projects were, it was about disparates getting together and getting along. I mean, it was going to be a, you know, a mixed race family, sort of like the Brady's, was a blended family from two step families. This was going to be an interracial family, and it's about time. It's about space. It's about being stuck in space, which is not that much different than Gilligan's Island being stuck on an island. So it's all about, you know, people being forced together and getting along, which, by the way, is a pretty strong idea, because it seems it's something that we can all use a lesson in.
Well, would you have been happy to go on for another season, or were you ready for it to end?
You know, I was really ready for it to end. So I had some issues. I mean, I don't, the girls, you know, and they're wanting to burn their bra, you know, moments, you know, it's all kind of natural to time. And so I'm, you know, 16, I'm an adolescent, I'm a little rebellious. Look, we're talking about, people say, you know, we're in odd times, and we are, but we were in our odd times in the 60s and 70s. I mean, 70, I was only like 18 months from having to be drafted, you know. Yep. I mean, we're talking Vietnam, we're in the height of Vietnam, or the end of Vietnam in 72, and all of that discourse and all of that angst. So I had this hair thing, which I look back on, recognizing that other people always have a better view of you than you do of yourself. But hair was important to me, as it was for a lot of people, and they wanted me to get my hair cut. And there was no way they were cutting my hair. It didn't matter how ridiculous it looked, which was pretty ridiculous. I was going to, you know, let my hair grow, because that was, you know, sort of, you know, my, you know, the one thing I would say no on. I couldn't change some of the stuff I was asked to do or say, but it just seemed it was childish and trite, and everybody, there was nobody smoking, you know, dope or, you know, getting pregnant. Our show wasn't about that. I look back on it and go, that wasn't the place for it. And even though that might be something you, as an adolescent, those are the things that you're going through, that's a different show. So it took perspective. It took being an adult, looking at it, recognizing now what it was that we were doing, but not having a consciousness completely of it at the time, and a recognition of what I needed to supply wasn't something that was in my sphere of influence. It wasn't about the Vietnam, wasn't about rebellion. It was about getting along. It was about the sweet stuff. And that's what I needed to focus on to have been happy to stay on the show, but I wasn't, my consciousness wasn't there at the time. So leaving it was totally acceptable to me. And I really wanted to go back to high school. I was missing, I mean, I'm a science guy, and I couldn't take labs in studio school. You know, I could take biology, but I would miss all the labs. You could take a it's all book learning. And as soon as a discipline required lab, practical lab, as part of the learning, that wasn't going to be a course I could take. And I was missing them all. So it was like, I was halfway through 11th grade when the show got canceled, and I was able to go back to high school and then pick all that up in that last year and a half. And I was grateful for that. It was good timing, but, I also missed, you know, a belonging. You know, this thing that we had created sort of happened, and the idea that it was, you know, we had caught lightning in a bottle became very real, you know, and all of a sudden you try to figure out how to, it just happened. If you try to engineer capturing it again, you start recognizing, wow, how lucky we were.
Yeah.
And then it would continue to grow. I mean, you would think that it would go away. Maybe it'll go away and I could now become an adult for real. And then somewhere in my 20s, I realized, you know, maybe this will never go away. And then what's wrong with it? So, you know, to me, I grew up with it, the Brady's being a very negative thing in my mom's eyes. It was banal. It was trite. It was unrealistic. And our family wasn't anything like that. And I wished our family was more like the Brady's. And there was a lot to, gain from the wholesomeness and the desire to get along. This working together thing that the Brady's was about was totally missing in my family. And I realized that that's probably one of the things that challenged my mom about the show, because to her, she gave up on that. And so watching the show challenged that or made clear that there was a shortcoming in our family with that. And I thought, you know, hey, there's nothing wrong with it. But she did. She undermined, you know, the feeling of the show during the period of time I was doing. Helped undermine, but I then embraced it and becoming an adult myself and looking back on it and realizing what it provided in the way of perspective and an alternative. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know? And so I probably the most vociferous defender of what the Brady's is, even though I was the least like it in growing up. And that's probably why I am its defender, because I know what it's like to live in an environment that doesn't have any of that excessive love and support. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I now value it more than ever and recognize Sherwood to be, you know, somewhat of a genius in keeping it that way, and how difficult it must have been with all this energy trying to pull you away from what your original idea was.
Hmm. Well, the show wasn't off the air for very long when the Croft show, the Brady Bunch hour came on. How did that all come about? And were you worried at all about now reprising your character in another format?
Yeah, I wasn't. We did the song dance thing, you know, I struggled with that mightily. So when this idea came along, it was like, what, you know, seems like a stretch to bring it back as a variety show. And I didn't want to sing it. I mean, I struggled so much in doing that song and dance stuff. I didn't want to do that. And then I was told that I wouldn't only have to do the opening and closing number. So I said yes to it, because I literally I was at UCLA and had to withdraw from school to do it. But they, you know, we made very little money. I mean, it was nice money for a kid, but our contracts were 5 years and the show lasted 5 years. So it wasn't renegotiation whereby we were going to recalibrate and earn maybe more closely to what we were, our value was. So the show's over and now they're asking us to come back. Now the purse strings open. Now real money is being discussed, and it was, you know, very attractive, because now as an adult, I'm living my dad's life, you know, trying to avoid living it. But being the, I didn't want to be near homeless. And, I recognize also going to school that most of the people I was science. So UCLA is divided north, south campus. And it's like, oh, sciences are south, and everything for me is south. And I've got friends who are all north because they're in theater arts and cinema, and they're studying to be in an industry I'm running from, that I have this great head start in. Why am I running from it? And it was just simply because it wasn't where my head was naturally, or originally, but I had grown into it. So I had to just recalibrate myself and realize maybe I should pursue the arts. And that's what that decision was the beginning of, and saying yes to doing the variety show. It cemented me being in the entertainment industry, where before that was a decision made for me. And the Brady's was sort of the tail end and the result of having someone else make the decision for me to be an actor. and doing the variety show is my, ironically, my decision as an adult to be an actor. And ultimately, I'd end up having to sing a dance to be an actor. So, you know.
You left for a bit to do to work in the computer industry. I mean, what prompted you to do that? And what are some of the things that you were responsible for then?
Well, the same thing has prompted me all along, not to be a near homeless person, you know? So I had, I didn't have a whole lot of faith in the entertainment business being one that could provide a white picket fence. Certainly it could, but it's not very accountable. So I always had this idea of a backup plan. And when I was in my late 20s, early 30s, that's when I started itching to put that in play. Now, I wasn't sure where that was going to be and how it was going to be, but like most things in my life, it's sort of just keep my eyes open and just keep plodding along, and eventually something, because I'm very curious, will catch my attention and perhaps take flight. And that's what happened. I had a lot of friends that were in the aerospace industry and the burgeoning computer industry as programmers, and I got sucked up in it. You know, for me, having some of the learning disabilities I didn't know I had at the time, you know, that were comforted by having a computer, writing on a computer and keeping my finances in a computer, was just for me. The computer straightened out my life, made order out of chaos, and I was enthralled by it. And as it turned out, then I find myself with individuals around me who had careers in the personal computer industry that then allowed me to a proximity and an opening to find a job in that industry. Mm-hmm. And it just sucked me up. It sucked me up and removed me from the entertainment industry. And so when that was then over 20 years later, I looked for something that perhaps I could come back to entertainment. Now try to engineer a way to weave the two together, so one doesn't have to do just one or the other. And that's what this new life of mine is now, this weaving of entertainment and business together. Mm. Simultaneously, well, not having to extract myself one from the other, but work them together.
Yeah. Well, just to talk about the Brady Bunch movie, which was so much fun, and you had a small part in it. How much fun was it for you to do, and your thoughts on the film and the cast's portrayal of you all?
I thought it was hysterical, but it's interesting too. It wasn't the Brady Bunch, so it causes one to realize that you can't make a movie about the Brady Bunch. It's really not movieable. It doesn't have any of the structure. And that's interesting, because to do the Bradys, you end up to have to do a fish out of water story. And then the Bradys become Mr. Magoo, you know, and it's like the Bradys had become something in that, they morph into something in that movie of an everyman, you know, superhero, like Mr. Magoo would be. You know, it's like accidental. But I understood where it was working. It's like an adult watching themselves, watching what they liked as a kid and laughing at the things that they used to believe, you know, but having a warm spot for it. So the movies were just it's a weird construct. And I heard from one individual who brought their like 7-year-old who's watching reruns of the Brady Bunch to the movie, maybe 8-year-old, 9-year-old, to the movie. And the kid just sat there, you know, wondering what he was watching. Because it wasn't like it wasn't at all like the series. So, yeah, because it was something completely different. And, but buying into that, it's hysterical. It's a send up. Yeah.
I want to ask about The Surreal Life. I love that show. There were so many sweet moments, but also a lot of drama. You were on the series before the term going viral even existed, but you would have been a moment of that. Because all I remember at that time that everyone was talking about the moment that how built you were. That, like, how amusing was that to you that that was that moment, like, was shocked everyone about that?
Yeah, no, I'd gotten into working out and trying to stay healthy, you know, in my high school years, and then just kept it up. And I just happened to have at that moment had, gone through a shredding leanness, and they caught me at the right time and you know, exposed it. So, yeah, that's that, you know, that's what happened during that period of time. You know, I pay the penalty now. My joints are crazily bad, but, you know, we'll work with what we've got. But yeah, I was always in the gym all the time.
I just remember everyone talking about, did you see Christopher Knight? But during the reality show, I mean, there were lots of events that happened. Besides with you, there were that season that you were on. There were also, like, you know, you came off as, like, really one of the most grounded in the house. There were events like with Vern Troyer or Jane Wheedlin. So I'm just curious, does that stuff happen organically, or is that something like the producers say, do this?
No. In that particular case, there was nobody telling us to do this, but it happened organically, but I believe it was cast that way. In other words, they're looking at different, now they don't know what's going to happen once you're in the house, right? But they might have inklings as to, okay, so if we can't have seven people all of the same type.
But
so they're going to look, I mean, certainly they're going to, you know, mix women and men and an array of personality to help the wheel go round. I mean, it's, and it turns out that, you know, I was, yeah, probably it wasn't hard. It wasn't a high bar to be the most grounded in that house. So, you know, to me, it was like, I was just sitting there breathing going, oh my God, I got 8 days of this. It was crazy.
Well, I want to talk about, you mentioned already the very Brady renovation. I loved watching that also. It came out a few years ago and all the Brady kids went to the original house, the one used the exterior, and they renovated to make it look like the original sets. How much fun was that to be in? And just how surreal was it to stand in the finished product and see, you know, the set is now a real place?
Most remarkable project one could ever hope to be part of, because it's more than the sum of its parts, especially for us. Here it is. It's inside out. We take a set that wasn't real. It was fiction, and a house that is misappropriated as that set and turn it into the set, but real. And that was the one thing missing from our set, is it wasn't real. And now we created reality from it. And I never thought it would be possible in that space. And it was remarkable. It was just to make real something that had slipped through, you know, was just in her mind. And then making it realer than it ever was just incredible. And it was, and the timing of it too. I mean, it was our 50th anniversary. It's like an anniversary gift that, the network presented us to give to ourselves. And, it worked for us. It worked for the network. And of course the house still exists now, and it's a museum piece of sorts.
Incredible.
And it was a character. I mean, the house itself is unlike any other set, I think, on television. One of the most recognizable sets of all time. And, you know, it was just crazy. It was just crazy seeing this, I mean, like the door opens, the front door opens, and now there's a street out there. You know, when we worked on that set, there was a fourth wall. They had walls to fly in, but it took too much time to fly them in. So they mostly never shot it in the direction where those fourth walls would have to be erected. So there's always a missing side to that living room, or in the boys' room or family room. And now we're in a house where that wall exists. It's like, oh, yeah, I got it. Great.
You'd mentioned already you and Barry started the Real Brady Bros podcast. So much fun to listen to. What made you decide to do it? And are there any things that come back to you while doing it that you can kind of forgotten about?
Oh yeah, all the time. I mean, the reason for doing it was I was asked by a friend. He said, you should do a podcast. I go, oh, I don't, you know, he says, well, you have a lot of ideas and opinions. I go, yeah, I probably shouldn't share them. And then it was pitched to us that this genre recap was actually a genre on podcasts, and perhaps we should do the Brady Bunch. And I'm not that guy. It was me and this other producer talking to me about doing the podcast. I go, well, if we do a podcast about the Brady Bunch, it really should, you know, Barry's the, you know, he wrote the book. So maybe Barry would be interested. So that we made a call to Barry. Barry was interested. So we joined up with, brought Barry in and joined up together then to create this idea of this recap podcast, whereby we're recapping something 50 years after the fact, which is in its own right, it's a hoot because, you know, we're misremembering all the time, but we do watch the episode and we haven't seen these episodes in 40, 50 years. You know, I mean, there are some episodes that Barry says he doesn't know if he ever watched. And now I believe I watched every episode on Friday night when it was out, but only, you know, half a dozen, a number of times. So I have no recollection of some episodes. Some episodes were fundamental in my life. I mean, I go back to them to realize I was going through something, and it was the episode itself was telling. Now looking back, like for instance, the Time to Change and singing and the voice cracking. You know, there was a lot of issues with that I went through during that week, thinking about why it was that they were writing me, you know, not being able to sing. I thought they were pointing out the fact that I couldn't sing. And, you know, there was limited trauma because of it. The Hawaii, because we are in Hawaii, you know, there's other episodes that we did over those, you know, 3 or 4 days. And that I don't remember at all. Huh. And then in watching them realize, I was there. There's my scene. I don't remember anything. So, and then the differences in our perspectives on what we were going through at the time. Okay. We're seeing the same thing. We're in the same scene, you know, but our views are different.
Yeah. Well, what are some things you didn't know that you learned from hearing things from Barry's perspective?
I didn't know about how he started. I mean, how he wanted to be an actor. I mean, he was 14 and, he engineered that. I mean, he already knew what he wanted to do, and nobody in his family was an actor. He had that consciousness of this whole industry. His friend or neighbor, his next door neighbor was Peter Graves. And, it was through Peter that he got, information enough to be able to go interview with an agent and find an agent. But it's always been something that Barry has wanted to do. And I didn't know that it went back that far. I had no idea that Barry was on it. I didn't know up until recently that Michael, I didn't know his family did a little kind of like a little Osmond thing. They went around to community centers and his mom played piano and they sang, him and his brothers and sister. Didn't know. I mean, a lot of stuff I didn't, you know, I wasn't aware of at the time. I mean, God, they come up all the time and now I can't recall. It's just so subtle. I mean, it's.
You guys were also just recently, like not recently, but you know, on The Masked Singer. It was so much fun to see. A lot of people on Twitter guessed, right? I just want to say.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. Yes. From the clues. I remember the clues at the time. And there were a lot of people on Twitter, like, you know, saying, you know, the Brady Kids. It was like trending a lot on that time. So how did you get involved with that? And were you all at it once? Or so like one of you had to like get the others to do it?
Was it my idea? You know, I don't know what it is, but, you know, utter the fact, you know, utter something you don't want to do and then have that be the thing that you're constantly asked to do is sort of my, the story of my life. You know, singing is something I want to put behind me. It's, and I keep getting asked to do it, you know, and I keep having to get, you know, supported or dug out by, you know, my brothers here. So this is something that Barry's always wanted to do. And I think it was through his people that it was pitched, and it came back that, all right, but we got to get three of you. And Barry laughed because he knows my position on singing. So thought that was never going to happen. And, you know, I guess I shocked him when I said, well, I didn't want to keep it from him. And it provided that I didn't look like a fool doing it. I've been there before, survived. And I know that Mike and Barry can, you know, can carry it. And as long as I'm not asked to do a solo, I'll do this thing. So I put some caveats in that they agreed to and then sucked it up and did it. And it was a tremendous experience. And they always are, you know, these experiences that I do that I'm reluctant to participate in. So I'm inclined to say yes, even when I've told the world I'd never do it again. And then I learned something from it. And this was a lot of fun. I think that Barry intended to win the thing and was more shocked than I was that we were invited off the island early. But I'm, you know, those costumes were hard to get into. So I'm okay not having to wear it more than I needed to. It was a fun, it was a great experience. It was a
fun to watch.
It was wild. It was wild. And I think we had a great deal of fun doing it.
Yeah. Well, you have your own furniture line, which is absolutely amazing and can be seen on your website, ChristopherKnightBrands.com. How did that come about? And tell us a little bit about your products.
So, one of the things that, been able to maintain over the years, one is a Brady by extension of having watched the show, because we really are that element. We're, a family, and it seems like I'm a brother to everyone. So there's a great deal of trust, which is odd. Sometimes people come up to me and it, you know, how you have, you know, it takes a while to get, you know, you first meet somebody and then you get to know somebody. And then after a time of knowing, you get closer and closer. And eventually maybe you get inside the inner circle. Like maybe you're invited to Thanksgiving or something, you know, very intimate and family-like. It takes time. Not here. I'm immediately invited to Thanksgiving, and everyone I meet, it's like they know me like a family member. A little odd for me because I don't know them at all, but they feel that way toward me. So there's a, and I've noticed this from being in business, there's a great deal of trust, and there's a requirement on my end that I don't damage that trust. There was an opportunity from a friend who was in this industry who wanted to create a brand who was already in the furniture industry. And he came to me with the idea. So it wasn't my idea. But I realized what he was asking, and that is to build a brand around this thing through my face, which ultimately rests on this level of trust. And the reason for that is at the time when we started this in 2011, 12, furniture was being sold on the internet, but it hadn't been long that it was available online, because it's more difficult. Like a car, you know, it's something that normally you go up and you drive and you sit in and you make a deal for right there. I recognize that now even you can buy cars on the internet, but furniture itself is also something you touch and feel and you go to a store for, or had gone to a store for, and because of the shipping element to it, how do you get it? So it had lagged behind product lines that were sold online. And people, if they were going to buy something that they normally touched and felt before, they're now going to be asked to buy it from a screen. There had to be a level of trust, some known factor in there to reduce the reticence in pushing the button to buy. We were right in that early arc of furniture online with this brand, and it took off as a result. And I'm very lucky to have been there and exercised this opportunity because when my good friend John came to me and asked me my feelings about creating the brand, I said, listen, I think you're nuts, but if you think it'll work, let's give it a shot. And that's like everything in my life. It's just this thing. It's this, something will come up and you'll jump on board and you'll ride it for a while. This one has been a hell of a ride. And the line keeps growing, Christopher Knight Home. And it's taken years that people that I know don't associate me with the line or didn't originally. And now it seems like everybody I know has at some point in their life purchased something that is a Christopher Knight Home product. So, and the big thing happened, during the Oprah interview of the Royals, where they were sitting in chairs that were sold by Christopher Knight Home, looked like chairs from Christopher Knight Home. We couldn't tell for certain. It wasn't as though somebody purchased them for the show and we knew all about it. But it became a big thing that, those are Christopher Knight Home products, and it's like, really, you're recognizing the chair? You got Harry and Meghan there sitting in them with Oprah interviewing him, and you're noticing the chair. But it was an honor. So it's one of those accidental successes. It's been quite an experience.
Well, I want to talk about your production company, former Prodigy Media. You have a documentary out, which we mentioned at the beginning, True Love, which can be seen on various.
Yeah, things. True Love, the film, our documentary about Callie True Love, who is this incredibly gregarious, charming young lady. We struggled in our production because it was right through COVID, so it took a while longer. So she's not 13 anymore now; she's 20. But when we did the show, we didn't realize how much of this special quality that she had was a result of her having Williams syndrome. We knew she had Williams syndrome. My partner and I, Phil Viardo, didn't know what Williams syndrome was. We didn't know how important it was in her, but we would explore that along the way. We find out that Williams syndrome leaves individuals like herself with this incredible social capacity and disarming capability. They don't have a red, so they're just wonderfully friendly. And we reacted to what she did with people around her, making them, opening them up, making them more friendly at a time when the world seemed it was going in the opposite direction. In other words, there's something about her that the world needed more of. And then to find out that part of that was supplied by this genetic disorder was remarkable. And that's what we learned. We learned more about Williams syndrome and as a result, giving Williams syndrome a lot more awareness, the awareness it deserves, that up until this point, it has struggled to be identified even by doctors. Yeah, we're finding people that, as a result of watching the movie, went out and got diagnosed. So
she's incredibly inspirational. I mean, I was watching it last night and just hit every emotion, like in a good way. And so I definitely urge people to go watch that documentary. It's, it's available, like I said, all the streaming services pretty much there. I saw it on YouTube, but it's on Amazon as well.
It was a project that we couldn't say what was our first project. And as a documentary, it was a digestible project for us because, we could self-finance it and we could produce it from beginning to end, not knowing where it was going to end up, which is an interesting experience.
Yeah.
But very positive. I mean, so positive in learning about what it is that those whom are in the shadows can provide all of us. You know, they might be called a disorder. She calls it her superpower.
Yeah.
You know, she calls her disorder her superpower. In a way, she's absolutely correct. I mean, it. I just wish that we all. She does something innately that we all need to exercise more as choice, and that is to be disarming, not to alarm people or distance them, but to embrace them and be friendly. What is that? What is being friendly? There's definitely a feeling we get from people when we say they're friendly, and yeah. She's that. And that friendliness is very important, because the absence of it leads us, you know, to distance and darkness.
Well, how can people get involved if they want to help or learn more about this?
Well, the film is available to watch wherever you watch, where you stream your programming. So, you know, from Amazon, from Apple TV, it's True Love, the film. It's also available on Tubi, I believe, with commercials. So wherever you stream, wherever your favorite streaming platform is, or what platform it is that you stream from, it's available. True Love, the film.
Hmm. Well,
and of course, from that, you know, learn about, you know, Williams syndrome.
Yeah.
And if you then want to, you know, donate to the cause or learn more about Williams syndrome, go to williamssyndrome.org.
Hmm. Okay. Awesome. Well, we'll former prodigy. It's my strategy. dysfunction.
So a story on that. So my partner Phil is a musical prodigy from Russia, and interesting, because it's a piano that he played, and that's what our logo is. I'm not the prodigy.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I was completely thrown by that, because I thought that's really quite brilliant.
And it's music again, right? Again,
yeah, but you know, I think you got a crossover, name there. That's awesome. Well, do you have plans for other productions?
Yes, we do. And not necessarily all across the board. So we are looking at films, reality projects. We don't have another documentary, although Callie would love us to, and we'll look into, you know, maybe, you know, potentially there could be a series with Callie. You know, it's, again, one of those things, one step at a time, and we'll find something. You know, we constantly are brewing ideas and or acquiring projects in partnership with others. And we started the production company 6 months before COVID hit. So it's been a struggle with that, and then the strike. So we're really only now gearing back up. So something will be happening in the future. I am sure of it. I just don't have anything concrete right now to share.
Well, hopefully you do. When you do, you're welcome back to talk about it. We'd love to have you.
Absolutely.
Let's end on, I want to ask one last Brady question. As I mentioned at the beginning, it really is an incredible testament to the staying power of the program that I was a fan growing up. And after all these years later, my kids are as well. So what is it about the show that you think owes to its longevity?
It's about kids, right? And when you watch a kid watch kids, they don't, I mean, up until like maybe 11, 10, really don't understand context, time. Right. I mean, I knew I was watching a show that was not of my time when it was in black and white. Right. Because then everything was in color or going to color. How much time? Who knew? But even today, it's just style. Maybe the clothes they wear that give you an idea that it was from another time. But when I grew up watching Spanky and Our Gang, it might not have been exactly like that. But I was drawn to these kids, you know. Kids watch kids, learn from kids. Younger kids watch older kids. So, and also they gravitate toward anything family, because that is their environment. That is their world. So our world might be, you know, out here and geopolitical, and encompass the entire globe. Kids is mostly that unit, that connection, and where they exist inside of that. And, you know, watching kids have fun with their brothers and sisters, innately in all of us when we're younger, we want that. We want the support, and we want to be liked, and we react positively to that which we look at that is working. That doesn't, that, I mean, that's, you know, Brady's is to me sort of like what Santa Claus is in December. It's just all of a sudden but it's all year round. Mm-hmm. It's this feeling of positivity and closeness and a warm blankie and everything's going to be okay. There's a place for that. And that's where kids start. And of course, then that's why we want to laugh at it when we're adults, because we realize when we're adults, it's not always like that. But it'd sure be nice if it was. Mm. How silly of me.
Well, I want to thank you again for doing this. It was such a treat, such a pleasure for us to get to speak with you. We're really looking forward to it. And my kids kept coming in, looking over my shoulder the whole time while we were here.
How old are your kids?
They're all older. They're like in their 20s, and my youngest is 18. My youngest was like the one that was here that's watching you.
That's what's weird. I mean, this filter, I mean, it's Brady's is a filter and everybody passes through it. And as a result, everybody, you know, has this common reference. And that's where it's, you know, the Brady's was just a project, a comedy project, entertainment, but it's transcended that and become a touchstone of, you know, for all of us that have passed through it as an idea of what family is, maybe from some perspectives, what it should have been, and to others who experienced similar things, what it was for them. So.
Well, again, thank you so much. You've been very gracious with your time. And like I said, anytime, you're welcome back.
I look forward to it when I have more to say about former Prodigy and you know, our projects.
Well, again, this has been Pop Culture Retro. I'm Jonathan Rosen with Ike Eisenman. And again, a very special thanks to Christopher Knight and Caber for setting it up. And please like, comment, and subscribe.
Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Retro, where no one was hurt during the making of this podcast.